the SR-71 Blackbird, how this remarkable aircraft came to be, and why it was funded. I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest again today is retired Air Force Colonel Richard Graham, who got to fly the SR-71 Blackbird during his career in the Air Force. If you missed yesterday's special feature, go to the archives and find part one from yesterday, and you'll be caught up on our conversation. Rich, I want to start off today by talking about the aircraft and the history of the aircraft, because I think it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a little bit in our earlier talk about Kelly Johnson, who was one of the guys at the Lockheed Skunk Works. The term Skunk Works is actually, I believe, a trademarked term by Lockheed.
Yes, it is.
And yet, I hear a lot of any small company that has a backroom project that is not exposed to the light of day yet, ends up being called the Skunk Works, I think, kind of as a tribute to what Lockheed has come through with theirs. But how did the Skunk Works get its name? Do you know that? And you know, how does a company get through the political process to get such a groundbreaking aircraft as this actually into the sky successfully?
Well, I never worked for the Skunk Works, obviously. I was in the Air Force flying the airplane. But, you know, somehow I believe, I recall the story that the Skunk Works, the logo of the skunk and everything, came from an Andy Capp cartoon.
Okay.
And one of the things they were doing out there at Lockheed, what they called the ADP, which is Advanced Developments Projects, that was what the real name is, the Skunk Works at the ADP, they were working on some project that produced an extreme odor at the same time, and someone said, let's call it the Skunk Works. And then the cartoon, the logo skunk that you see a lot for the Skunk Works, came from an Andy Capp cartoon, I understand. Now, I could be wrong on all that, but I seem to recall that was the story.
All right. Now, what I've been able to read about Kelly Johnson and the design of this plane, the original design was called the Archangel by Lockheed, but Kelly liked to call it just the Article. Does that suggest that perhaps he knew he was developing something that would be one of these career-defining aircraft?
I don't know personally, but you're right. That was Archangel. It was 1 through 12, and that's where the A-12 came up. You know, there was an A-1, 2, all the way serialized up through 12, and the A-12 became the one that actually went to production that the CIA flew. I don't know that much about what Kelly calling it the Article versus, you know, Article Archangel or whatever. So I'd just soon step out of that question.
Okay, not a problem. I have to say that of a lot of the aircraft we hear about, sometimes the names take some head scratching to figure out. But everything that this airplane has ever been called along its development path seems to make sense. I mean, it was called the Blackbird. It was called Archangel. All these names kind of make sense for it. How groundbreaking was this when they started working on this in the early 1960s? Was this in response to anything that the Soviets were doing at the time, or was this just a design to be a leapfrog?
Well, I'll put it in perspective. Kelly Johnson designed in Lockheed, at the Skunk Works, they designed the U-2 in 1955. That was the date of its first flight. Come about 1957, 58, the Russians were getting much more aggressive in trying to shoot down the U-2. And people like Kelly and a few others knew that someday that the Russians would probably get a U-2. And if you recall back in your history books, on May 1st of 1960, Gary Powers did get shot down over Russia with an SA-2.
Oh, yeah.
And prior to that, around 1958, because of this, Kelly started conceptualizing an airplane that would go higher and faster than the U-2, and he started to work with it and develop it. And right after Gary Powers got shot down on May 1st of 60, at that time, Kelly got all the money, the authority, the latitude, and the secrecy to build the SR-71, or the A-12, if you will, which is the original version. And the amazing thing was, and again, considering this is all slide rule technology, no computer aids whatsoever, from the time he was given that money and authority and latitude, 22 months later, he had rubber on the ramp.
That's astounding.
And that's his first flight, which was May 26th of 1962.
And you mentioned that
April 26th of 1962.
Okay. You mentioned that earlier that there was some a pretty severe learning curve to this aircraft, in that a lot of them were lost early on, just because of things that crews were learning about how to operate them and weight and balance and all these things. It's remarkable to me that these guys came as close with the design on the first iteration as they did, because some subtle changes were made over the years, but essentially what rolled out on the ramp in April of 1962 didn't undergo a lot of major structural or what would you call it, strategic level design changes.
No,
over the years
exactly
it was
right.
up there.
You're exactly right. It didn't. Computers improved, the inlet performance improved, but those were all internal. But as you say, the structure of the airplane, that what you see is what you get. That A-12 and the YF-12, which is a little bit different, but the A-12 and the SR-71 are very, very similar in characteristics. There's hardly any, to the naked eye, you couldn't even observe any differences.
Now, we've heard a lot of amazing stories that obviously can't be backed up, not just about the SR-71, but about the military's reconnaissance capability in general. Satellites that can tell you whether a dime is heads or tails, or look over the shoulder of somebody and read a newspaper. And I do not doubt that, especially in this age of computer enhancement, there are things that we have capabilities that would boggle people's minds. But going back to this early in the space age, you guys were carrying some things that, just from a pure optical standpoint, had remarkable capabilities.
The cameras were very, very good, particularly back in the late 60s and 70s. And in the 80s, about 1981, we got a very sophisticated radar nose on the airplane. It was called the ASARS, and that stood for Advanced Synthetic Aperture Radar. And it was a radar imagery, and it gave us then all day or night capability, all weather capability, anytime you want us, we can get good imagery. And that resolution, and it had several modes of operation, but in the spotlight mode of operation, it would get down to a 1 foot resolution, which is really good for radar.
And I have read, I've looked at radar screens before, and frankly, this is a little hard for me to picture. Flying by an open hangar door at very high speed and very high altitude, and being able to tell what kinds of aircraft are in that hangar using radar, how was that done? I mean, that just sounds...
Well, that assumes one thing, and it can be done, but it assumes that the hangar door is open. The radar imagery back, it bounces off and goes inside and comes back as a return. And we could get pictures of what's actually inside the hangar or anything that's enclosed. But obviously, once you close up all the sides, it's not going to penetrate through the earth or the steel. That's a little bit of... That's beyond. They may have that technology today, but we didn't have that, trust me.
Well, and if they do, you don't want to be standing in the way of it.
That's right.
Well, now, did this become a target? I mean, were these targets of opportunity that would just come up along the route?
No.
I mean, you couldn't necessarily plan a half an hour even ahead that a hangar door would be open.
No, the mission planners, they planned missions weeks in advance. And that's why you had to stay on the black line. And the targets were all picked out well in advance, and the computers were programmed. There's a computer on board the airplane. We nicknamed it R2-D2, but it's about the size of half the size of a giant refrigerator that fit right behind the RSO seat, just in front of the air refueling door on the backbone of the SR. And inside that computer, it orchestrated everything on the airplane. It told which camera to look where, at what time, at what angle, on the left and right side of the airplane. It was orchestrating everything on the airplane.
My guest is Air Force Colonel retired Richard Graham, one of the pilots of the SR-71 Blackbird. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Platt, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Piperjet.
Hypersport.
Piper Match.
Global Expansion.
Meridian, Mirage, Matrix, and more.
With so much happening at Piper, how can I possibly keep up?
Get informed. Get involved at facebook.com/Piper Aircraft.
Freedom through innovation. It's what led us to develop Cirrus Flying 2.0, the framework for a bold new take on private aviation. And as a result, the gap between the aircraft we produce and those of our competitors continues to widen. Cirrus knows where the personal aircraft industry is headed. We're already there.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today about the SR-71 Blackbird with Air Force Colonel retired Richard Graham. You have written two books about the SR-71. One is called SR-71 Revealed, The Inside Story. Is this a book where we would expect to learn some of the politics involved in the creation of the aircraft, or is it...
Well, a little bit of the politics right there, but that book, I wrote that, everything became declassified in 1990. Right. That was the airplane's first retirement. In 1996, I wrote SR-71 Revealed, and what it allowed me to do was talk about things that were previously classified, and it talks quite a bit about those kinds of items. The missions are in there, and a lot of good stories I got from other crew members, and I got so much support from the crew members that from both books that are out, I sent all the royalties to this National Air Space Museum, and they're still going there today, as a matter of fact.
Now, you mentioned the other guys who flew this thing. Do you still keep in touch? Did this experience produce a kind of esprit de corps similar to what maybe astronauts feel?
Yes. In fact, when you actually add up all the numbers, and I've added them up as close as I can, of all the crew members who flew the SR-71 operationally, and I say operationally because there's a lot of, you know, four-star generals and senators and congressmen and VIPs who wanted to get a one-time flight in the airplane. I don't consider them crew members. So of all the crew members who flew it operationally on, you know, intelligence gathering missions, I come up with 93 pilots. Mm-hmm. So that number is a lot less than the total number of astronauts. We get together every 2 years in Reno, Nevada, and have a Blackbird reunion there. Now, that includes not only the crew members, but we invite, you know, the maintenance folks, the Lockheed folks, the Skunk Works, all the guys and gals that worked on our sensors and all the tech reps that maintain that equipment. We have about, last reunion was in June, and we had a little less than 400 show up.
Tell us a little bit about your career after the SR-71 days.
From the SR-71, I flew it for 7 years, and then one day I was asked if I wanted to be the squadron commander, and the downside of being the squadron commander for the SR outfit, it's the only squadron I ever know, a flying squadron, where the commander does not get to fly the primary airplane, which is the SR. So I had to make a real decision, so I thought, yes, I'll take the squadron, and shortly after that, my flying days were over in the SR-71. Then I ended up going to Air War College for a year out in Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama. Then that got me to the Pentagon for the next 4 years, where I had a staff job. And from the Pentagon, I got out of there in 1986, went back to Beale Air Force Base, was a vice wing commander. And in 1987, I was fortunate enough to be selected to be the wing commander at Beale. And I did that till I retired in 1989. And fortunately, in 89, when I retired, American Airlines was hiring old crews, old pilots, and I came aboard with them and got 13 years with American Airlines and hit the magic 65 years ago. So, after 5 years.
You may have been the only guy who went to work for the airlines to fly low and slow.
No, we actually, at American, we actually had 12 SR former crew members that were flying for American Airlines.
What do you fly for fun these days?
Well, I'm flying with the Civil Air Patrol. I like the squadron. I like the mission. I'm also instructing up at McKinney Airport, just teaching students how to become private pilots. I like to get them fresh and teach them what I know. And Civil Air Patrol I enjoy, and that's what I was flying this weekend.
Well, listen, Rich, we appreciate you taking some time out. It's been fascinating to talk to you about this aircraft. My guest has been Air Force Colonel retired Richard Graham, and you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.